You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My first guest is Patricia Morris Rowe.
She is the biographer of Robert Mapplethorpe. She's written for many publications and has written the books Wide Awake, A Memoir of Insomnia, and Nine and a Half Narrow, My Life in Shoes. Her new book is The Woman in the Moonlight, Patricia Morris Rowe's first novel. It's a historical novel about Beethoven and the woman whom he dedicated the Moonlight Sonata. Patricia Morris Rowe, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much.
I don't want to give anything away, Patricia Morris Rowe, from your new novel. So tell us what you would like people to know.
Beethoven met this young woman, Countess Julie Guicciardi, around 1801. And during that time, it was an incredibly difficult and traumatic period for him because he was recognizing that the hearing loss that he'd been experiencing for the past 4 years was not getting any better. And at the time, Beethoven was Vienna's foremost piano virtuoso, so he knew that it would probably signal the end of his performing career. And he meets this, he's 29, she's 19, this beautiful, vivacious young woman. And he writes to a friend, Franz Wegler in Bonn, where Beethoven grew up, that he's met this dear, enchanting girl. And it's allowed him to kind of come out of himself. And he says, "She loves me, I love her. It's the first time I have thoughts of marriage, but she isn't of my station." So he recognizes this probably isn't going to work out, but she came into his life at a really pivotal moment. And this is true. I mean, this is based on fact. So then I took that as a jumping off point, but also spending 35, 40 years in journalism, I couldn't stop researching. So I tried to make it as accurate as I could, given that there was not that much information on Julie.
So you made up a lot of this story, is what you're saying?
Well, the story of Beethoven's chronology is as accurate as one could possibly make it. And the times that Julie met Beethoven in the book are the times when she had moved to Naples, but she came back. So I made up the dialogue, and yes, I made up a good part of her story and their relationship beyond what we know happened, which was that year that he was in love with her. He may have been in love with her a lot longer. It's hard to know. But certainly every fact about Beethoven, apart from their personal relationship, is accurate.
It seemed to me, Patricia Morris Rowe, that you were kind of creating a scenario in which we could see Beethoven not as a relic of the past, but as kind of a rock star. I thought this too when I was reading your piece about George Bridgestone that you wrote in the New York Times the other day, where you had him kind of, it was like Eric Clapton and Jimmy Page. There were groupies and destroyed hotel rooms and all that kind of stuff that we associate with rock stars.
You know, you're so right. And I didn't think of it at the time, but that is so true. I mean, Beethoven and Bridge Tower going out, carousing, being rowdy, perhaps overturning chairs, picking up women, very much. And Beethoven, they always talk about Beethoven being the first rock star. And, you know, even though he was not traditionally handsome, he did exude a tremendous amount of charisma. There were a lot of women in his life. None of them ever worked out, primarily because Beethoven's great love was his music. But yes, I mean, women were attracted to Beethoven. The biggest problem was he mostly met aristocrats, and as much as the young women's, the family, their parents, you know, were enamored of his music, you know, there was no way they were going to let their daughters be Frau Beethoven. That wasn't going to work out.
A few years ago, I was in Naples, and I went to this museum there, and they had a secret cabinet, it was called, and you had to go in by appointment. And in this secret cabinet, they had relics from Pompeii that were all of a sexual nature. And I think the thing that struck me was that, oh man, they had sex then, you know, and not only did they have sex, but they had sex toys and all kinds of sexual things, you know, dildos and statues of men having sex with goats and all kinds of crazy things. And that, that secret cabinet turns up in your story.
Yeah, I was in Naples this past August because I wanted to check out, you know, in one scene I have Julie, when she arrives in Naples, looking out the window at Vesuvius, and then I sort of got panicky. Maybe that's the wrong view. Maybe she's, so I said to my husband, we were in Ravello, but I said, we've got to go to Naples. And I went to the archaeological museum, and I said, okay, well, I'd read a lot of books about that, but those were the relics, and that they, it was pretty shocking. But you know, what was shocking to me, people have said to me, there's a lot of sex in this book. And I actually didn't, you know, intend there to be. And I don't know really, when you think about it, how much there really is. But I was surprised at the sheer decadence of that society. And that is firmly based in history and people's diaries and everything else.
I think every generation thinks they invented sex, and they're shocked to find that previous generations have also contemplated it.
Yeah.
you've now become kind of a historian of Beethoven and his music and his period. I mean, you really did a lot of research.
I did a huge amount of research because I went into it knowing, I mean, I took piano lessons, I took voice lessons. I mean, I was serious about music growing up, but, you know, I kind of left that behind. So I had certainly gone to Beethoven concerts, but apart from knowing that he went deaf, I really didn't know very much. So I was starting from ground zero. And I remember picking up Jan Swafford's magisterial biography on Beethoven, and it's like 900 pages, and thinking, oh my gosh, wow, I think I've bitten off more than I can chew. But I read a lot. Now, having said that, I read, in terms of listening and analyzing his music, I spent most of my time, obviously I listened to as much Beethoven as I possibly could during the period I researched, but you know, I really focused on the pieces that Julie herself would be around and would have been hearing. You know, the Ninth Symphony, the Moonlight, the Emperor Concerto, the Waldstein she plays. So it was more than that. I mean, I didn't say, okay, I have to understand the Grosse Fuge she listens to, the late quartets, but it wasn't the entire work that I am an expert on.
Well, there's a lot, but you know, had he lived another, you know, 75 years or so, there might have been recordings of his playing. But obviously the only way to record his music then was through sheet music and notation. How do we know that the music that, as we hear it on Deutsche Grammophon, is the way that he played it or that he envisioned it?
I don't think we do know. I think the closest thing is to listen to it on period instruments. And I got involved as part of my research, and then it became part of pleasure with the American Classical Orchestra, which is out of New York, and they do period instrument concerts. As a matter of fact, I just collaborated with them on a project where I wrote an essay with the wonderful forte pianist from the Netherlands called Petra Simlai, and she's playing the Moonlight on a reproduction of a 1785 Walter forte piano. And there is a difference. There really is a difference. So that helped me a lot, just to immerse myself in that period instrument world.
Right, the piano forte, what is that exactly? How does that differ from what we think of as a piano?
It evolved. The history and the evolution of the piano evolved with Beethoven, because Beethoven was never satisfied with anything. He wanted more from the instrument. He wanted more power. He wanted more range. So it had fewer keys. The pedaling was different. You know, among my expertise is not necessarily historical period pianos, but they, through Beethoven and his relationship, particularly with a female piano maker named Nanette Stryker, he helped push the piano forward. I mean, before we had a harpsichord and then the pianoforte. And it became larger. The keys, they increased under Beethoven.
In your novel, you kind of tell a little bit about how Beethoven as a composer began to kind of push the boundaries of what had previously been expected of that kind of music, that he kind of was pushing it a little bit to the outside, maybe a la John Coltrane, or that he included vocal music in the Ode to Joy, and that had not been done before.
Yes. I think, you know, people always say, oh, how could Beethoven? I mean, also people think that Beethoven, they'll always say, oh my God, he was stone deaf from the beginning. And that was really not the case at all. The hearing loss kept on progressing, but he could still hear, not marvelously, but he could hear. I think that Beethoven always went his own way. You saw that in the Third Symphony with Eroica, and you saw it with the Moonlight Sonata, where you have this, you know, fantasia. It's after a fantasy, after a fantasia, which is an improvisation. So when the Moonlight Sonata came out, people had really never heard something like that first movement before. And in fact, most people only know the first movement because no one can play the third because it's so difficult. Whereas in Beethoven's lifetime, the Moonlight Sonata, which wasn't called that then, it was a huge hit because people loved it, and the first movement was well within the range of talented amateurs. Everybody was playing the Moonlight Sonata, the first movement, so much so that Beethoven got sick of it, and it was like, can't they play something else? I think I've written better things, he said.
Like a rock star today constantly having to perform their greatest hit.
Yeah, it's like, can't get no satisfaction, yeah.
So, and he was really a performer as much as a composer?
Yes. Well, that's how he started out. I mean, he was an incredible, I mean, it must have been thrilling to listen to Beethoven perform, because he, you know, at the time they had what they called these musical duels. They were like, it was like gladiatorial combat for aristocrats. And whoever, you know, was coming into town, the big like piano virtuoso from England or Paris, they would have to play off with Beethoven. And those duels were incredibly exciting. And he was a master at improvisation. So I think that was very difficult for him when he had to stop performing. But of course, he had an extraordinary talent as a composer, which a lot of other pianists didn't have.
You have a scene in your book where someone comes upon Beethoven and they think he's asleep, but really he's got his ear to, he's composing, he's got his ear to his piano.
Yes. I think a man named Theodor Albrecht, who did Beethoven's letters, is now, he's translating. Beethoven had conversation books when it really was very difficult for him to hear. People would write down their questions in the conversation books, and then he would answer. And there are quite a few of them, and for some reason they have not been, I think only one or two or a certain period of time, they've been translated into English, but the rest of them are now being translated. And Theodor Albrecht did some interviews this spring where he talked about having evidence from those conversation books that Beethoven could hear a lot longer than we thought he could. Not well, but it was because he talks about the ear horn he used, and he is advising someone, don't try to rely on that. It's why I can still hear somewhat out of my left ear. So I think that is going to change people's perception of what went on with Beethoven. And he also had built this gigantic sound machine that went over his piano that helped to amplify some sounds. So he tried absolutely everything he could, even towards the end, remedies, you know, like herbal remedies, if you smash up some nuts and, you know, make a paste out of it. He always, I think, thought he could overcome the hearing loss, as he overcame everything, really.
So in some ways, you're an actress who's playing the role of Giulietta in this.
Well, yeah, and I started out as a drama major and wanting to be an actress. So, yes, in many ways. And in many ways, you fall in love with the character and you mourn him when he's gone. You know, I think my husband was getting a little sick of listening to Beethoven talk about Beethoven, you know, and he was a very good sport about a lot of it. But, you know, it was like, do I have to listen to Grosse Fuge one more time? Because that's a tough one to listen to for some people. So, yeah, you have to. And how can you not? I mean, Beethoven, extraordinarily difficult human being. I mean, he just was. And he treated women, his housekeepers, just, you know, this one's a beast. He liked pretty women. He liked, you know, pretty cooks and pretty housekeepers. But then he got very paranoid. He thought they were stealing from him. So he was really a difficult human being. But the music is, you know, it's both so overpowering and masculine, but then there are just moments of tenderness in the music that just break your heart that they're coming from the same man.
Again, it sometimes sounds like you're describing a rock star who has, you know, their virtuosity allows them to be pigs or horrible people.
Yeah, I mean, at one point he wanted, I think he always wanted a son. And there was a real ugly period where he tried to get custody and did get custody from his sister-in-law of this poor boy, Carl, who he wanted to turn him into a musician. And, you know, Carl just was not Beethoven. His last name was Beethoven, but he didn't have the musical talent. And he was quite horrible to his sister-in-law, who he dubbed Queen of the Night after the evil character in Mozart. So, he lived in a total pigsty. I mean, there were the salami next to the red herring, next to the Missa Solemnis. I mean, the And he was moving constantly. He moved like 68 times. So to be with him would have been just absolutely impossible.
Well, you really take us into the world of this, of Beethoven, and I really appreciate you doing so. And the book is called The Woman in the Moonlight, a novel. And the author, my guest, the brilliant Patricia Morris-Rowe, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. I enjoyed it. Thanks.
Patricia Morris-Rowe, author of The Woman in the Moonlight, a historical novel about the woman who inspired Ludwig van Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. In 2015, reporter Ted Koppel published a frightening book called Lights Out, A Cyber Attack, A Nation Unprepared, Surviving the Aftermath. And I had the opportunity to discuss that book with Ted Koppel here on From the Bookshelf. And today, we'll listen back to that 2015 recording. Ted Koppel, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
What you're saying in Lights Out is that a laptop in the wrong hands is a weapon of mass destruction.
Yes. I mean, what I'm saying is that the Internet, for all its many virtues, has also exposed us to something that the creators of the Internet many years ago just never envisioned. Nobody thought the Internet was going to be anything other than a device by which professors could exchange good ideas. So when the Internet was first designed, the notion of hacking attacks was never considered. And so now, in the aftermath of all of that, it is essentially impossible to completely defend the Internet against attack. And because our electric power grid is effectively controlled by and run by devices that operate on the Internet, the grid is vulnerable, and that means that potentially an attack on the grid and taking down all or part of a grid could leave tens of millions of people without electric power for weeks or even months at a time.
And in your book, you lay out how awful and terrible that would be. How likely do you think it is?
Well, what I think is truly irrelevant. I did what reporters, I think, are supposed to do, and that is I went to the smartest people I could find on the subject, and it is what they think. And there are, I'm afraid, remarkably well-plugged-in people in this country, from the president on down. President Obama has twice in successive State of the Union speeches warned of the danger of cyber attacks on our infrastructure, singling out the power grid. Our former Defense Secretary, Leon Panetta, spoke of a cyber Pearl Harbor. The current four-star general who heads up CENTCOM, General Lloyd Austin, has said it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. So again, it's not what I think, it's what all those people have told me.
Well, Ted Koppel, you discuss many of the causes of our vulnerability in Lights Out, including the state of television news. How has news changed, and how did it make us vulnerable?
Well, I'm not sure that I would go so far as to say that I was blaming television news for the vulnerability of the grid. What I am saying is that the nature, we've really come an awfully long way from the days when Walter Cronkite was the most trusted man in America. And these days, as I write in Lights Out, it's almost impossible to convince the American public of anything that it's not predisposed to believe. So the idea of, I cite as an example, the question of President Obama's place of birth. A fairly extensive poll was taken, and the question was posed in a way that should have made it very easy for people to say, well, can't be sure. The question, as I recall it, was something like, are you certain that the president was born outside the United States? And 37% of those who responded said yes. Now, if we really live in a time where 37% of Americans believe at this late stage After all the investigations that have been concluded on this, that the president really wasn't born in the country and therefore is sitting in the White House illegitimately, then I think it's fair to say that it's very, very difficult to convince people of things they're not predisposed to believe. So convincing people that the electric power grid is vulnerable to a cyber attack and that it is really an issue that transcends partisan politics. This is not something that ought to divide liberals from conservatives or Democrats from Republicans. It's something we need to discuss in a national conversation, because there are things that can be done, if not to absolutely defend the grid, at least to prepare people better than they are currently prepared for the consequences of a grid going down.
Well, I want to follow up on that in a minute, but let me ask you another thing about TV and TV news. You know, Jimmy Kimmel, it's an entertaining program, but do you ever just, like, get angry when you see that there's nothing remotely like Nightline on the networks anymore?
No, I mean, I'm enough of a realist to understand that because of the explosion of media, because of the fact that it's no longer just the three major networks competing against one another, you've got all the availabilities on satellite television, cable television, what's available on the internet itself, I understand that the need to be competitive is just far more severe than it ever was over the almost 26 years that I did Nightline. And therefore, what the network has concluded is that it needs a program that is a little more entertainment-oriented than the old Nightline used to be, and that's what they've got.
Not that Nightline wasn't entertaining. I always found it very entertaining.
Well, that's kind of you, but you're a geek.
that's probably true. In your book, I'll just follow up one more thing about TV. In your book, Off Camera, you kept a journal of the year 1999. You remember that book?
I do. I wrote it.
Yeah, it was a good book. And you said something in there that you said that ABC News had made a decision, along with other networks and other news outlets, to stop collecting their own election returns and to all agree to accept one feed. And I was thinking about that a year later when, in the election of 2000, do you think that was one of the things that was responsible for the debacle of the 2000 election, when it kind of fell upon Gore to concede rather than simply say it's too close to call, let's count the votes?
No, I don't think so. I mean, that really was, the election was so close in Florida, and everything was hanging quite literally on how Florida turned out. I think even if all of the networks had done their own polling and their own returns, it probably would have ended up the same way.
Well, you know, our political thinking, you know, is really divided, as you were saying earlier. But it's interesting how in the 60s it was the left that was, you know, distrusted the government and questioned authority and all that. And now it's the far right that distrust the government to the degree that they become the preppers, the people that you talk about in your book who are preparing for disaster.
Well, I wouldn't call all preppers people of the far right. In fact, what really distinguishes preppers from survivalists, I think if you talk about survivalists, you have images of people building their own concrete bunkers and they're waiting for the black UN helicopters to show up. That category of people, I think, does belong in the far right. Preppers tend to be far less partisan. And you have preppers of the left and preppers of the right. Essentially, a prepper is nothing more or less than someone who is prepared for catastrophe, whether that catastrophe happens to be a personal one, that someone in the family dies or loses a job, or whether that's a natural disaster, or whether it's the kind of thing that I'm writing about in Lights Out, is really beside the point. Preppers are just people who are not ready to rely on the federal government to take care of them. And the reason I spent time with them and on them is because I found in talking to people who have the responsibility of helping people in times of crisis in the federal government, that there really is no plan for what I'm writing about.
Well, I mentioned earlier, Ted Koppel, that your new book, Lights Out, is really scary, and you did that on purpose. You want to scare me and everyone who reads your book to scare us into action?
I want people to understand that what I'm writing about is not just a sort of far-off hypothesis of something that theoretically might happen, but don't really sweat it because it probably won't. I've come to the conclusion, based on conversations with people whose opinions I value and trust, that this is very likely to happen.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. We're talking with Ted Koppel. His new book is called Lights Out, A Cyber Attack, A Nation Unprepared, Surviving the Aftermath. I had a friend who was positive that the Y2K crisis was going to occur, and he filled his garage with stuff and was extremely well prepared for that one.
Yeah. Was your friend the former chief scientist of the NSA? Was your friend a former defense secretary? Was your friend the commander of CENTCOM or the president of the United States? I'm not sure that I'd put what happened before Y2K in the same category. I'm really not. I understand that a lot of people in government and even in positions of authority believed that all of our computers might go down in the year 2000.
It might happen. Yeah.
It might happen, but I don't think the predictions were quite as firm and dire as the ones that I write about. And again, ultimately, the wonderful thing about this country is people can make up their own minds. And if they don't want to become more prepared, that's entirely up to them. But I think the job of journalism is to look into issues like this and at least make the public aware of what's out there. And I think in this instance, I mean, I talked to Janet Napolitano, who was for almost 5 years Secretary of Homeland Security, and when I asked her about the likelihood of a cyber attack on the grid, she said, you know, very, very likely, 80 to 90%. She's not given, this is a woman who is now the president of the University of California. She's not given to making sort of wild predictions just for the fun of it.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're listening back to an interview I recorded in 2015 with reporter Ted Koppel on the occasion of the publication of his book, Lights Out, A Cyber Attack, A Nation Unprepared, Surviving the Aftermath. Well, let's talk a little bit more about how we got here. To what degree did deregulation add to our vulnerability?
A great deal, because the deregulation of the power industry, the electric power industry, created a system under which there are now 3,200 different companies. Not to get too wonky on you or your audience, what happens, what is essential about the generation and the transfer of electricity is that in order for the system to survive, there has to be a perfect balance between the amount of electricity that's generated and the amount of electricity that's consumed. The only way to keep that in perfect balance at all times within that system of 3,200 different companies is through the Internet, through what are actually called SCADA systems. These are supervisory control and data acquisition. What they do is make sure that that balance is maintained at all times. If somebody, if hackers get into that SCADA system, and NSA experts have told me that both the Chinese and the Russians are already in that system, they have the potential of taking it down pretty much at the stroke of a key. Now, as long as it's just the Russians and the Chinese, that's actually not the worst news in the world, because we have so many interlacing and interlocking relationships with both Beijing and Moscow that they are unlikely to do it. As you go down the scale of capability, though, you go up the scale of likelihood. The Iranians, somewhat less capable than the Chinese and the Russians, more likely than the Chinese and the Russians to do it. The North Koreans, a little bit less capable, a little bit more likely. ISIS, not yet capable of doing it, although I've talked to some experts who believe that they could buy the expertise and get the equipment that they need essentially off the shelf. But a group like ISIS has absolutely no inhibitions about doing something like this. So they represent an enormous threat if and when they get the capability.
Okay, you're getting me all scared all over again, Ted Koppel. Why do you think people like... Why do you think people do these things, the things that ISIS did or 9/11 or some of these things?
Well, I mean, you know, why do we have wars? Why do people bomb each other? Why, you know, ultimately, the history of mankind is a history of warfare, and it may have begun with clubs or, you know, sharpened sticks and graduated to lances and swords and bows and arrows and ultimately, you know, explosive devices. The fact of the matter is, as long as there are weapons that can be used by one person or one group or one nation against another, they're going to be used. And as I say, the tragedy of the Internet is it was designed for such positive intent or with such positive intent. And the fact that it can be used, and we have evidence of this every single day, quite literally thousands of times, that it can be used, you know, for grand larceny, that it can be used, as the Chinese did just about a year ago, to vacuum up millions of personnel records from Americans who worked at the CIA and worked at the Pentagon and worked at the State Department. You know, it's just inevitable. If a weapon is there at some point or another, it's going to be used.
Well, speaking of weapons, what part does the proliferation of guns play in the scenario you describe in Lights Out?
Well, the fact that we have 300 million guns in this country and the possibility, even the likelihood, that tens of millions of people will be deprived of everything they need to live, not just comfortably, but to live at all. Food, water, heat, lighting, cooling, refrigeration, the ability to dispose of, in a city, the enormous quantities of human waste that are generated every day, is inevitably going to result in many, many tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people, potentially leaving an urban center and moving out into other parts of the country, seeking not just shelter, but light and food. To the extent that they have the money to pay for it, all well and good. To the extent that there is enough available food to feed everyone in those places, and the influx of potentially hundreds of thousands or even millions of domestic refugees, all well and good. When the food runs out, when space runs out, when shelter runs out, you have a situation that you can watch unfolding right now in Western Europe, where quite literally millions of desperate people are looking for shelter and food and a place to settle because they are fleeing intolerable conditions. Am I suggesting that Americans fleeing from one part of the United States to another part of the United States is going to be identical to that? I'm not, but I am saying when people are desperate and when those who have the food and those who have the ability to shelter themselves don't have enough to go around, and you live in a culture that has 300 million guns, the guns are going to play a role.
We're chatting with reporter Ted Koppel. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. You talk a lot about the Mormons in Lights Out. you went and spent some time in Salt Lake City.
I did.
And what did they teach you about this situation?
Well, the Mormons are a people who, for almost 200 years in this country, were subject to not just enormous prejudice, but were tended to be driven from one state to another state until at one point they had a city in Illinois that was almost the size of Chicago. But their leader, Joseph Smith, their prophet, and his younger brother Hiram, who was his chosen successor, were imprisoned and killed by a lynch mob, and then the group led by Brigham Young made their way out to Salt Lake City, and over the course of that time, and since then, Mormons really have become. It's almost a part of their, not almost, it is a part of their culture that they are prepared for the worst. And so Mormon families are encouraged to have a 3 to 6 month supply of food in their homes. The Mormon hierarchy has ensured that there is enormous food production and production of all necessities from Mormon farms. Mormon apiaries where they have beehives and generate an enormous amount of honey. They have herds of gigantic herds of cattle and heifers to generate dairy products and meat. The Mormons are prepared, and I cite their example in the book, not because I think that what they have done can easily be duplicated. It can't. But they do provide some examples of what people can do for themselves and as communities, which I think is worth looking at, worth studying, and in some cases worth copying.
So do you think the internet genie is out of the bottle? Is there any way to roll it all back to, I mean, you and I both lived in a world before all this happened.
Yeah, and our great-grandparents lived in a world before automobiles killed 50,000 people a year in this country, as they did during the 1970s. And, you know, we still kill 25,000 people a year on our highways. Is anyone suggesting that we give up the automobile? We're not. We are prepared to pay a terrible price sometimes for conveniences that have simply become irreplaceable to us. The automobile, the truck, the bus, the motorcycle simply falls into that category. I can't imagine if we were fighting a war right now and losing 25,000 young men and women every year, that there wouldn't be a tremendous uprising in this country saying, let's end the war. Let's get out of wherever it is. But because of the great convenience of the automobile, we're prepared to put up with that kind of an annual sacrifice. And I think the Internet has pretty much gained that same kind of stature and standing in this country, where it is now so much interwoven into the way that we do business and into the way that we communicate, the many conveniences that the Internet provides us. You know, whether it's Siri on our iPhones, or whether it's the ability to simply plug a location into a GPS system, all of that comes to us by virtue of the Internet. It's something that carries a multitude of blessings. But I'm simply pointing out that it makes us vulnerable in another area.
But the people who live in urban areas are much worse off. I mean, if you're living in New York in an apartment on the 25th floor, you can't really have a herd of cattle.
No, in fact, it's difficult enough even to have a food supply. But you can have something. I mean, there are things you can do. But you're absolutely right. People in our rural areas are much more capable of surviving an event like this. I mean, for the simple reason, if you're living out in the countryside, you can have an emergency generator. and you can have a sufficient fuel supply to keep it going for a very long time. And with that generator, you can generate enough power to keep yourself, if not totally comfortable, at least you can survive. And people, people tend to hunt in our rural areas. They can fish in our rural areas. There is water available in our rural areas. The city dwellers are going to have a much harder time surviving something like this. And if you were to knock out the power in a city like Kansas City, where I am right now, or in Chicago or in New York, the consequences would be grim.
Ted Koppel, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Take care.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.